Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined as usual by the inimitable Jeremy Goldcorn, the man behind Danwei.com. How are you, Jeremy?
Good evening, Kaiser.
It was funny running into you yesterday at Jenny Lu's at Rutan. Ufei is looking very ripe. When's your due date again?
You know, right. You Americans like to overshare.
Yeah, we do. I think that it's important that we all know that you are. I mean, I think I made reference.
As like, I said, you Americans like to overshare.
Crash. Just so we'll know when to buy you cigars, Jeremy. Okay.
Soon.
Okay, very soon. Anyway, we're very glad to have back with us today David Moser, a longtime China Watcher essayist, jazz pianist, and all-around great guy who works as academic director of Chinese studies at Beijing CET. Wonderful to have you back on Seneca, David.
Wonderful to be back. Thank you.
We are also very honored to be joined by Professor Victor Mayer of the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to Seneca, Victor.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Yeah, great. Dr. Mayer, for those of you who aren't aware of his work, is a leading scholar of the Chinese language. He takes a keen interest in everything from its early forms through its contemporary romanization, pinyin, of which he has been an ardent advocate. He's actually just showed me a memoir that he wrote. Actually,
not his wife. My wife.
Oh, your wife.
My late wife. It's her memoirs.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Your late wife's memoir. Entirely in pinyin. You've even been interested in the way that Chinese is kind of hybridized with English to become that funny little language that my children speak natively, Chinglish.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about Chinglish later on in the show. You know, they're fond of saying little things like, Chitting, Babu Bali, and I'm going to say they say Vibu Violent.
Vibu Violent. Yeah.
Or the Tibu Ticklish. It's great. I love it.
Or close the door. I am Guaning.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Guanmen.
Oh, my daughter said, Mommy, I'm Guangjing Pigu.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
I love that. Oh, my God.
I'm lying Chou Chou.
Yeah,
I get that. I'm lying Baba. Yeah. I get that.
As I said, you Americans like to overshare.
The Oversharing Podcast, thank you. Yeah. Dr. Mayer's intro goes on. He's published numerous books from translations of the Dao De Jing. It was the Ma Wangdui edition, in fact, right? Which was a Western Han tomb that was unearthed near Changsha.
Yeah, early 2nd century BC.
Yeah, and that other great work of Taoism, the Zhuangzi.
Right, that was fun.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's some beautiful writing. That's actually some of the best writing in classical Chinese. Also, Sun Bingfa, he also did
exactly.
The Art of War.
Yeah, I did that.
And he's also done some very well-known work about the Bronze Age mummies that were discovered in the Tarim Basin in what's currently Xinjiang. And you've also written on the history of tea. I mean, what haven't you written on? My God.
The podcast's almost over now.
I know.
We haven't even gone a third of the way through the resume.
Right. I can assure listeners that I'm actually leaving off a whole lot more than I've already included. But anyway, you can see why we're completely psyched to have Dr. Victor Mayer on our little show. Before we plunge in, I do want to remind listeners that they can follow us on Twitter at Cynical Podcast or like us on Facebook at facebook.com/CynicalPodcast. Please come join in the conversation on the Cynical Facebook page. Give us your feedback, your suggestions, your hate mail, your share links, whatever. Stories that we think we should be reading or topics we should be talking about. Anyway, in last week's show, we spoke a bit about a groundswell of anti-foreignism in the context of a couple of videos that had made the round on the Chinese internet, one of alleged sexual assault of a Chinese woman in Beijing by a putative British national with the beatdown that followed it, and then the second of the Russian cellist Oleg Vedernikov, who very rudely refused to take his feet off of the headset of the train seat in front of him, and who used some very serious Chinese profanity, all of it caught on video, a cell phone video. Now, adding fuel to this, we have CCTV News broadcaster Yang Rui, one of the two hosts of the show Dialogue, which, David, both you and I have appeared on numerous occasions.
Mm-hmm.
So first question is to you. Anyway, a few days ago, Yang Rui wrote the following on his Weibo account. I'm sure everyone has seen this in translation on numerous occasions, but he writes, the Public Security Bureau. Should I do my Yang Rui imitation? No, I'm not.
Since you'll never go on there again.
Go on there again. Anyway, right. The Public Security Bureau wants us to clean out the foreign trash, to arrest foreign thugs and protect innocent girls. They need to concentrate on the disaster zones, Udalco and Sanlitur. Cut off the foreign snakeheads. People who can't find jobs in the U.S. and Europe come to China to grab our money, engage in human trafficking, and spread deceitful lies. What other sort are there? To encourage emigration. Foreign spies seek out Chinese girls to mask their espionage and pretend to be tourists while compiling maps and GPS data for Japan, Korea, and the West. we kicked out that foreign bitch and closed Al Jazeera's Beijing bureau. We should shut up those who demonize China and send them packing.
That was the Wall Street Journal's translation.
That was the, exactly right. I should credit Josh Chin of Wall Street Journal for that lovely translation.
Amen. I believe I agree with that 100%.
Actually, I read this.
The translation or what Yang Rei said?
I read this and I thought it was maybe satire, albeit in bad taste, but I was wrong. I mean, not about the bad taste. It really was in bad taste.
It was in pretty bad taste. I mean, it reminded me, a lot of people thought it was satire. And there's a law, kind of like Godwin's law. What is it about a fundamentalist tract is impossible to distinguish
from satire.
Yeah. It was a little bit like that. Many people thought it was satire.
Yeah, I was trying to give him a way to satire. He didn't take it. In fact, he went even more belligerent afterward. Right, David, is this the Yang Rei that you know?
No, you mean you and I have been on that show even together a few times, and he's unfailingly, he's very polite.
Yes.
He can sometimes ask the occasional probing or, hard-edged question, but I always assume that's his job. You know, he's supposed to represent China. I emailed a friend of mine who's also been on that show dozens and dozens of times, and he just says, I think he just lost it.
Something pushed
him over the edge. Like either that or he's beginning to believe his own. He's sort of forgotten that he's not merely a lone agent there. He's part of the mouth and throat of the party or the tongue and what is it, Hosha, Dang de Hosha. And he's not just like Glenn Beck or, one of these.
Who's another Dang de Hosha.
Yeah, but I mean, he's cool, not getting paid directly by the government, but. I just think he lost it. But I do suspect that this is something he's been thinking for a long time.
And it just came out.
Yeah, this is the first time it came out.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he was just trying to build a bigger Weibo following. Jeremy, what was your reaction to this? And catch us up on what's the latest.
Well, the weekend, we're recording the show on a Monday, which is earlier than usual. And so this is up to date till Monday, May 20.
First.
21st, sorry. Over the weekend, a number of people, including me, tweeted in horror on Weibo about Yang Rei's statement.
I tweeted in horror
about Yang Rei. And Charlie Custer of China Geeks also posted a demand that Yang Rei be fired from CCTV, which... Mm-hmm. Together with the journalist James Fallows on his Atlantic Monthly blog, writing up a rather horrified post about Yang Rei's tweet, seemed to drive Yang Rei into a frenzy, and then he threatened to sue Charlie of China Geeks for libel. He subsequently deleted those tweets. I hope very much that nothing comes of this. I really hope very much that nothing comes of this, and I hope everybody can just cool down a little bit.
Yeah, I think he's gone from high dudgeon to maybe a medium dudgeon.
But is he like Kong Qingdong at all? Is he of that?
No. Kong Qingdong is always like that.
Opens his mouth and it's profanity.
And out comes the bile and the vitriol. Yeah, Kong Qingdong.
But you don't hear much from Kong Qingdong anymore.
No, you really haven't. Not since
Kong Qingdong and Sun Anan have been lying pretty low since the fall of Bo Xilai.
Yeah, so that has brought about a lot of good things. A lot of snakes have crawled back into their holes.
Snakeheads.
But anyway, I mean, I was very surprised, and I really hope that Yang Rei is contrite about this and that he realizes that. I mean, there's no self-respecting foreigner is going to go on the show.
I think he also may have been fallen victim to the mistaken belief that some people fall into, which is that Weibo is only between me and my personal, fans or whatever. He maybe forgot that some other people besides his loyal fans read that.
I think he may have forgotten that there is no longer a wall,
That's
a linguistic wall.
Exactly.
That people actually read this
in Chinese.
Right, Chinese. Right. Which brings us to my next topic. Here I want to make this the Victor Mayer show because, we have such a rare opportunity. A mutual friend of ours, the very accomplished young translator, Brendan O'Kane, who often freelances here for Pop-Up Chinese, he once wrote about what I think he termed feral sinologists, who began their academic lives at a time when the Chinese mainland was accessible, in contrast to the scholars who came up during the Cultural Revolution or even before, for whom, you know, China was a sort of distant and forbidding and quite inaccessible place. So these guys actually learned to speak Chinese, and whereas the earlier people who had, you know, had been born in the 1930s and 1940s really had no access to China. I mean, they treated Chinese as more or less a dead language. I mean, right. Victor, somebody who is often credited as being one of somebody who's not from this very young generation, but who nonetheless has encouraged students to actually learn the living language. What was your approach to that?
Well, I think it's because I was in that generation where I had a chance to go to Taiwan, mm-hmm. and I learned Chinese pretty well in Taiwan. And I have to say, I learned most of my Chinese with Guoyu Ribao. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
Me too.
You did. Both there. Of you yeah, had Guoyu Ribao.
Guoyu Ribao, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, actually, I learned how to read Chinese with Guoyu Ribao. It's called Mandarin Daily. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, well, if I'm going to study Chinese, I better learn to speak it. But my teachers at Harvard, they didn't speak it. Like Hightower was a very fine sinologist, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and I've never heard him speak Chinese.
What about Fairbank? Did he speak?
Fairbank, I don't think he spoke Chinese either.
Really?
At least I never heard him speak Chinese.
It's really quite shocking. I mean, a lot of these people. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people who studied under these towering figures in sinology. I mean, and a lot of them just simply
don't. Well, so, I think Whaley didn't even want to go to Arthur Whaley.
Right.
I think he made the statement. He's famous for saying, like, I don't want to go to China. The only thing I get in China is diarrhea.
Well, that's a good reason to keep away. But I mean, your research interests are just famously, famously wide ranging. For someone whose discipline is ostensibly philology, I think this is actually a terrific argument in favor of the tenure system.
Oh, keeping me around.
Yeah, you can just go do whatever
Let
the fuck
me do
you
whatever
want.
I want. Right, yeah, exactly. I do like to proceed that way.
Yeah, so I don't even know where to start with. I mean, you've studied everything there.
Let's start with mummies.
Let's start with mummies. Yeah, mummies.
Well, mummies are the last thing I've been working on, but we'll start with the mummies and work backward,
okay,
perhaps.
Mummies and work backward. Okay, so anyone interested in China is definitely aware of these guys, the famous Tarim mummies. They're impeccably desiccated, preserved very, very well. You got like the witches of Subeshi and the beauty of Lolan. All these things are quite famous.
And the witches with their Naven.
Weird conical hats. Yeah.
One of the reasons I got interested in the mummies is because the very best preserved one that really captured my attention when I first saw them was a guy that looks like my second oldest brother, Dave. And I called him Ur David, because I mean, really, he's this.
That's where that comes from, Ur David. Yeah. I thought you meant that, like, you know, no, David is from David and Goliath.
Yeah, and you know, when I give lectures on the mummies, I often show first Ur David, and then I show my brother, and it just looks like the same person.
And does your brother recognize this similarity?
Oh yeah, I've shown him. I've let him see this too.
And what is your own ethnic origin? You're not
I'm Austrian.
You're Austrian, okay.
Well, I'm American, but of Austrian on my dad's side. Okay. And that has something very much to do with the mummies, because from 1972 to 1988, mm-hmm. I was a scholar of Buddhist popular literature. That's what I did my PhD on. And, you know, the manuscripts from Dunhuang, the mm-hmm. Dunhuang Caves, I worked on them for 20 years. But in 1988, I was leading a group from the Smithsonian Institute. And I went into the museum in Urumqi, and I saw the mummies for the first time in 1988. And that was the first time they were exhibited. So I was among the very first people to see the mummies. And I just filed them away in the back of my mind. And because I was not an archaeologist, I didn't feel like I had anything to do with them. But in 1991, in the fall, I was at the National Humanities Center in North Carolina, and I read the Washington Post and the New York Times front page news. Utsi the Iceman had been found, mm-hmm. Well, 5,300 years old. And I read it with great fascination. And there was like an army of researchers working on Utsi. And at that very instant, in Chinese, I said in my own mind, I said, "Bu gong ping." That expression just was riveting to me. Bukongping, it's not fair because everybody is studying these. An army of researchers is working on ISI, and nobody's paying attention to the Tarim Basin mummies. So that very afternoon, I started organizing an expedition to go out there and do it because they had just fallen through the cracks. They were too far in the middle of Asia for people from China or from Europe to be interested in, and they weren't getting studied. So I started organizing my expeditions from that moment. It took me 2 years, from September of 91 until the summer of 93 when I took my first expedition. That's how I got into the mummies.
Meanwhile, presumably you had done a literature search in Chinese. Had Chinese archaeologists or
paleoanthropologists? Because the mummies caused a problem for China because they were obviously Caucasoid or Europoid. And right away, the Uyghurs grabbed them and said, these are our ancestors. You know, like, we were here before you. And it got to be a very controversial, very sensitive subject. And I walked into the middle of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's talk about that. I mean, one's stance on the origins of the Uyghurs and the order in which the Tarim Basin oases were occupied has become kind of a shibboleth, right, for how one stands about attitudes about even Uyghur independence, right?
Yeah. Well, it started out that everybody thought I was on the side of the Uyghurs. The Uyghurs and the Han thought so.
Uh-huh.
But I was on nobody's side. And quite frankly, I don't think these mummies are related to anybody that's still alive now.
Right.
Because after all, probably they were speaking they may have been speaking Tocharian, mm-hmm. which died out in the 10th century of AD. And some of them may have been speaking an early Iranian language, and that kind of Iranian no longer exists.
But it's still Indo-European, right?
Yeah, Indo-European, yeah. But not Turkic.
But not Turkic, yeah.
That's quite correct.
Right. And, I mean, I'd always learned that the Uyghurs came from the Orkhon Valley.
You're right. And when did they come? They came
in
the
mid-ninth
century,
right,
845 or something like that. They entered the Tarim Basin. So what emerged was that I actually ended up taking the side of the Han, but not on purpose. And I really upset the Uyghurs because they thought I would be speaking for them. And I didn't want to speak for anyone. I didn't want to speak for anybody but the mummies.
Right, now, so your evidence for them is what, paleolinguistic, or is it
DNA?
Is it DNA evidence,
yeah.
Right?
There's
and
DNA,
do the two match pretty closely?
Well, you can't connect language and genetics directly, but what you have to do is bring together circumstantial evidence from a lot of different fields, and even textiles. I took the two greatest textile experts in 1995, Elizabeth Barber and Irene Good, ancient textile specialists, and I found out that textile analysis is equally specific or even more specific than genetic analysis because you're dealing with the twists of the threads, even you use electron microscopy I have trouble with that word every time. To study the scales on the individual fibers, where were these sheep from? And dyes and all sorts of the weaves. And we do have plaids, by the way. We have actual plaids from, but I'm not saying they're Celts. Although people have put words in my mouth and said that I.
Because I mean, I think you used the word tartan at one point.
Yeah, right? I did. But it's actually, usually I like to say diagonal twill, diagonal twill. That gets me off of
the shit list.
The Celtic ship.
Okay, so now let's go through the timeline for habitation. So you have the earliest Bronze Age settlers who were related, I think, to the Afanasevo culture.
Yeah. Ooh, you've done your homework.
A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we think that they were probably related to Afanasievo or...
Sorry, when is this exactly?
That's, you know...
These are cultures that are up on the...
Third
millennium BC.
Yeah, third millennium. But these mummies... I mean, late third millennium. Third
right,
millennium
so like 2000 BC. Right.
Yeah.
2000 BC.
But the mummy... The earliest inhabitants of the Tarim Basin were about 1800 BC.
Okay.
So what we're working on now is the roots where they got down into the Tarim Basin. Where were they coming from? And I have to say that very much overlooked is the evidence from physical anthropology. You know, and it's a bad word now, and nobody likes to talk about it in America and in the West, but craniometry.
Right.
Craniometry, because of what happened in World War II, But there's a very fine Chinese physical anthropologist named Han Kangxin, and I've worked with him very closely, and I think that his analysis of the skull shapes actually very closely corroborates what we know from archaeology, like from tomb types and from movements of people in and language movements and migrations. So it's a whole combination of many different types of evidence that we use to try to figure out who the people were and where they came from.
And this puts them in what, far Western Asia? This,
well, I mean, some of the chromosomes we're getting now are definitely Western Europe. I mean, Europe, Western, Northern West, Western Europe. Some, I mean, but it's not specific. You know, it's like a large majority, a large percentage of the people with these markers are from Europe. And that matches well with the fact that we think they're speaking Tocharian.
How I mean, there's so much possibility at every twist and turn for contamination, right? I mean, isn't it entirely possible that one strand of your DNA ended up in there?
Unfortunately, the people who have done the latest studies are from Jilin University and Fudan University. So if there were contamination, it would come up looking like a Han.
Yeah.
And there's tremendous amount of precautions used to prevent the contamination.
Okay.
Every article in ancient DNA spends at least half of the time talking about how we prevented contamination.
Right.
And then, yeah.
Maybe you should mention just for the audience why this is interesting, why it surprised the academic community, and that's the issue.
Yeah. So what I mean, is it that interesting? I mean, I
oh, it moved the, you know.
Well,
because we've always seen that. Okay, so for me anyway, I mean, knowing lots of Uyghur people, it's sort of well established that there was sort of an Iranian kind of proto-culture that was there, that was present, at least from like the first millennium.
But it's the time frame that's surprising, right?
It's so early.
Yeah, it's so early. Right. No one believed it was right. That early.
Yeah, that was shocking because we know from Han, you know, we know from Chinese history books, Shiji and Han Shu, that there were people who looked like monkeys and were hairy.
Yeah, see, this is the thing. But they were thought to be mythological accounts.
Yeah, they sort of
like
mixed
that
up with the Shanghai Jing.
Right.
Yeah. And then they had deep-set eyes, and they were almost subhuman or superhuman. Anyway, not really human, fully human.
Mm-hmm.
But then to get these bodies.
Nothing has really changed if one looks at the last week. Anyway, sorry.
Very good story.
All about
related to the current events.
Yes. Nice.
Let's get back to the topic.
Okay, so but this other Caucasoid type that was in from around 700 BCE, they're sort of like Saka-speaking Iranian people.
Yeah, there's another wave that comes in, and actually, mm-hmm. you know, Han Kangxin's physical anthropological studies matches this very carefully. You know, these different groups coming in with physical types, which I love. And people don't like to study his work, but I push it as hard as I can
because of its sort of Nazi associations.
Yeah,
it's craniometric.
I mean, I don't care about it. It fits the evidence.
Okay.
Yeah.
I won't call you. And then what about the East Asians? When did they actually begin to enter the eastern part of the Tarim Basin?
Well, Mu Tianzidruan, you have that. Do you know that book? It's the travels of Emperor Mu of the Zhou Dynasty. It's semi-fictional or mythological, but there's evidence of travel out into Central Asia by Chinese in the first millennium, early part of the first millennium, Western Zhou. And also the Shang Dynasty was getting jade from there.
Mm-hmm.
And the Fuhao, you know, the...
The jade axes.
Yeah, her tomb was unlooted, and there are 700 pieces of jade there. And the chemical assay shows that most of them were from Xinjiang. So right. there was contact between Central Plains and Xinjiang. I don't like to say Xinjiang. I call it Eastern Central Asia.
Right.
Already in the late second millennium. Well, now with these mummies, I mean, wheat came to China through this way. I mean, the wheat is a Western import, and we're finding wheat in the grains, which we carbon 14 date. They're extremely important for the importation of wheat into China because it shows up at just the right time in Central Asia, Eastern Central Asia, and then it shows up in China a couple hundred years later, 100 years later. So this is one of the reasons that the mummies are so important, because it tells us about the spread of wheat.
Of wheat, which was cultivated in the hilly flanks in Anatolia,
right?
Starting in 8,000 BC.
Gets into Jared Diamond territory,
right.
Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Yeah, right.
The vertical, the horizontal transmission.
So the other horizontal transmission question that's fraught with political implications for some reason is bronze.
Oh boy!
Oh yeah.
Here's another one, right? Okay, because
these mummies had bronze.
They sure did.
And the best. Well, when I first put out the idea that bronze came from the West, it caused a lot of uproar, and people were very angry about it.
Well, couldn't they just call it even, since you had already established that the Caucasians?
Now I would say the younger metallurgists in China, like Mei Zhenjun, who's trained at Cambridge. And even others who haven't gone abroad, they now accept pretty well that bronze technology came from the West.
Yeah, I mean, why shouldn't they? I mean, bronze metallurgy just shows up, I mean, quite fully fledged in Shang, right?
There's
a very complicated of the Chinese people.
It's a very complicated technology.
Right.
But then
the bronze artifacts that you find on the Terran mummies is copper. I mean, it's copper and zinc. It's an alloy. It's not. Copper and tin, rather.
Copper and tin.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's real bronze.
But actually they don't bury the tools with them. We have evidence that they use tools because we can see the cut marks, for example. Uh-huh. And we have little bits of tin. It must have been. I mean, little bits of bronze. Bronze. It must have been very expensive, and very costly and rare. But they do put little bits of it in their burial posts and so forth. We know they had it for sure.
Wow. Well, and so now, but you say the young metallurgists are all pretty accepting now of this theory.
Right. I was at a conference in Baoji, the precious chicken out in Shaanxi. We had a big international conference on bronze metallurgy. And
you were invited.
I was invited, and everybody there was saying, yeah, bronze comes from the West. Everybody.
It's nice to see that they've
If we have time, I can tell you a little story about Casey Zhang, the famous Harvard archaeologist.
Zhang Guangzhi, yeah.
Yeah, Zhang Guangzhi. I knew him for a long time. He was dying of Parkinson's. So, it takes a long time for a person to waste away. So I went to visit him in probably about 96 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, 97 perhaps, yeah. And there was a very famous Chinese archaeologist here in China called An Zhimin. He was probably the most important person for bronze metallurgy. And he came to a conference I held in China on the mummy, the first big conference on the mummies in 1996. And he gave a paper in which he said, we have to reconsider the origins of bronze in China. And he was one of the first very important Chinese archaeologists to say that.
To raise this heresy.
It may have come from the West. I think he wrote his very first probing article on that in 1993. And anyway, I went to see Casey Zhang at Harvard in his gigantic office, and I said, Casey, An Zhimin says that bronze comes from the West. And Casey looked at me and says, he did. And I said, yes, Casey, he did. And then Casey said, he's a great man. And I said, why do you say he's a great man? And Casey said, because he can change his mind.
That's great.
Very nice.
That's one of those terrific, one of those encouraging stories about science. I think, who is it? Dawkins tells such a story.
Right. A story about an older physicist, I guess, who was listening to a paper.
It was a evolutionary biologist. It was about
a biologist, right?
The Golgi apparatus. I think it was about
the punchline being, he stood up and shook his hand and said, "Thank you, dear sir. You have changed. You have overturned my 20 years of research."
And that's what scientists are supposed to be all about. You're supposed to have falsifiable hypotheses.
That's what science is all about.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about Pinyin.
Mm. Yeah, let's talk about Pinyin. Enough of the mummies.
Although the mummies are fascinating. Really fascinating.
How did you first come to study Pinyin, Victor?
That's a great question, because actually at first I was a very strong opponent of Pinyin, because I believed in, first of all, I believed in tonal spelling, wire jaws, Guoyu Romazi, national romanization, where you spell in the tones. I thought that was the most intelligent, that it worked best, And that people who learned that way learned to speak Chinese very well and remembered it, like spelling.
Let's quickly explain what that is.
Tonal spelling?
Yeah.
Okay, so ma, 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 right? So first tone would be M-A, second tone M-A-R, third tone M-A-A, fourth
right.
tone
Double
M-A-H.
Volume, right?
Ma, ma, ma. And you don't have to put a diacritical or a number.
That's right. So there's vestiges of this, actually, in, like, if you look at the Shanxi.
Right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Shanxi is spelled with a double A, right?
Right. That's the one that's canonized in the Chinese opinion now.
Right. Although I will see people, I grew up with a kid whose surname was Tong, and it was spelled T-O-R-N-G.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. And my sister-in-law's Li Horn, Li Hong.
Yeah,
Li Hong.
Yeah, and people say Horn.
Horn.
I've heard people say that they can tell what romanization person learned their Chinese by their accent, especially from that era. You can tell Wade Giles people or, you know, opinion people.
Well, there are so many people who pronounce, I don't know why, but I can't stand it, people who pronounce Da Xue as Da Shui.
Oh, no, but that's just bad. That's just bad.
Okay.
That's just stupid. Yeah.
So actually then I thought, okay, I wrote my first papers as a graduate student in GR. And I stuck to that for 3 or 4 years, even when I started publishing things. And then I switched to Wade Giles because that was standard and editors didn't like me to use GR. So, you know, like when the International Standards Organization and the United Nations picked Pinyin as the official standard for Chinese throughout the world, I actually resisted, and I thought it was an imposition mm-hmm. that we should be able to use our own romanization. But then isn't it strange that I become an ardent advocate of Pinyin? I mean, there's probably no one who's more strongly in favor of Pinyin than Victor Mayer.
Yeah,
so it's kind of ironic.
And you're also an old friend of the father of Pinyin, whom
Zhou Youguang. Yeah. Yeah, I just came from him,
He lives just a stone's throw from here, right?
It's just really 500 meters away.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let's go. 107
yeah. years wow. old.
Yeah, and he still has all of his acuity and sharpness and really smart, and he's active, he still writes.
Yeah. The tenure system and Pinyin.
we know the
secrets now.
Yeah. But, you know, I published a Pinyin journal in the 80s for about 10 years, and it was all in Pinyin, and my wife just wrote her, my late wife wrote her memoirs in Pinyin. So it's functional. It can be done.
And you are one of those who goes so far as to advocate that Pinyin supplant Chinese
characters. No, I'm not.
Okay.
Right. Okay, thank you very much for asking that, because so many people believe that and accuse me of that falsely. I do not.
That's why I believe that hesitation in my voice.
Which characters should be relegated to the dustbin of history. No way. I think that there should be something called digraphia. In Chinese, you would say shuang wen zhi.
Uh-huh.
It means let there be two parallel systems of writing.
Yi guo liang wen zhi.
Yeah.
Very good.
So, very good.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, we have situations in the world of digraphia, like Hindi, Urdu. It's the same language, essentially, but with two scripts. Serbo-Croatian, same language with two scripts.
One written in Cyrillic, one written in Latin.
Right. So, I mean, I would love to see a situation where people could write Pinyin if they wanted to, or they could write Hanzi. You know, what's happening is de facto it's developing that way. Because you'll see people write Pinyin when they can't remember a Hanzi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're just, and then there is actually,
my children do that, right?
Yeah. There was actually an educational program sponsored by the Guojia Yuan Wenzi Gongzuo Wei Yuan Hui, which is right down the road. And it used to be called the Wenzi Gaige Wei Yuan Hui.
Mm-hmm.
The Script Reform Committee, they had a program called Zhu Yin Shi Zi, Ti Chen Du Xie. That means, like, use phonetic annotation to recognize characters
right.
And speed up the reading literacy, and writing
right.
of speeding up literacy in Hanzi. And it worked very well. There's statistical proof that the kids who got to use Pinyin as much as they wanted actually learned Hanzi better.
Well, yeah, I mean,
that makes intuitive sense to me.
To me too.
Like, don't get caught up on being able to write every single hands up. You don't just, you know, the great thing about my wife as a Chinese language teacher, she would encourage her students to just write the Chinese and don't get hung up on every single character. If you can't write a character, write it in Hanzi, in pinyin.
Yeah. Good. Good.
So, but, you know, with IT, pinyin inputting IT, with the cell phones and computers, in a way, it's a pinyinist. People are getting so familiar with pinyin that they develop character amnesia, which
is something that's clearly happening. I mean, it's happened to me like crazy. I can't not have a device near me if I have to write an address down.
Right. It's becoming increasingly a Chinese problem, too. I think one of the stumbling blocks that you run against many times is that Chinese themselves will claim that they could never, ever learn to read a text in pinyin. It's just impossibly
difficult. That's a psychological block.
Even though what you're saying, you know, when they do a text message, all over Beijing, millions of times a day, you have people inputting pinyin to get the characters onto the screen,
right.
And then the other person is to go. If you could just go directly to pinyin, the person who's receiving the script is also pinyin literate.
Right.
So why not just avoid the middleman? But they claim that they can't.
Where do you guys come down on the use of V as a substitute for the umlauted U?
It's great.
I think so, too. I think it's genius.
I have a friend out in Xinjiang, a very fine archaeologist. His name is Liu Anguo.
Yeah.
And he writes L-V-E-N-G-U-O.
Yeah. I think it's brilliant.
That would solve the one diacritical problem.
It does.
Yeah. Well, that's the way people do input the it's almost like semi-official, I would say, the V.
Yeah, it has become semi-official. And I mean, it's the one letter of the 26 English letters that isn't used.
They have 25 letters in the pinyin.
So why not use that one? And it happens to look like a U. So what happy coincidence!
Exactly.
I mean, I'm glad we've solved this. I mean, I've heard it. I've heard you accused of having been.
So many people do that to me, and it's totally unfair, unjust. I'm a professor of classical Chinese, and I love to teach classical Chinese. And how could I teach classical Chinese if I don't have the characters there? All the texts are in that. And one thing that also must be noted is you cannot use pinyin to write out classical Chinese.
Right.
Now, there you have too many homophones because it's one syllable, one syllable.
Exactly.
And we have lost a lot of the phonetic richness of earlier forms of Chinese.
Right.
It was something I called phonetic nivellation, a drying up of the sounds.
Nivellation.
Yeah, like Nivea.
That's quite a word.
We for those who are really interested, I'd like to just interject two sources that they can go to find out more about this. One is Bill William Hanaus's book, The Asia's Orthographic Dilemma. Orthographic Dilemma. Mm-hmm. It goes into great detail about all the more than we could possibly do in a podcast. It talks about not only Chinese, but also Japanese, the problems of Japanese and Korean.
Right. These morphemically.
And then also
languages.
A great website run by Mark Swofford called pinyin.info.
Right.
And it has a great resource for all these kinds of literature as well as some articles. And he's got a wonderful article in there about the problem with literacy and the Hanzi in there and the problems of even assessing what literacy is and the fact that a lot of the accounts, the statistics that the Chinese government puts out of wild things like, there's 95% literacy in the cities and 90-something in the countryside is bogus. And it's because of the fetishization of Chinese characters that they say, if you know 2,000 characters, then you're literate.
Oh, yeah, right.
Which is ridiculous, right? And then in the countryside, they lower it to 1,500. We can't do anything with 1,500 characters.
No, we certainly can't. Believe me, I have tried.
And you try. So anyway, that's those two sources, and Mark's site is an excellent source for debunking all these myths and stuff like that.
Well, cool. Let's leave off the pinyin topic, and I'm going to get a little even more wonky here and talk about the Ma Wangdui tombs and some of the texts that emerged from that, because you've done translations of the Ma Wangdui Laozi,
right?
What's the difference between that and the other received texts of
Kaiser? I think you're going to have to explain just a brief soundbite.
All right. Yeah. Ma Wangdui, these are Western Han tombs from the 2nd century.
In Hunan.
You've probably seen some of anyone who has an interest in sinology. There's this beautiful burial shroud that everyone has probably, it's in every Chinese textbook ever printed. But included in the texts were two copies of the Laozi, the canonical text of Taoism, as some would say. There was also the Shi Liu Jing, I believe, is that correct? Which was is supposed to be a text of Huang Lao Taoism. Mm-hmm. Actually, when I was a graduate student, I translated a big swath of that when I was studying under Don Harper, right at Arizona.
I think you're leaving out one interesting thing that people don't know. The Maung Day, the tomb was sealed off hermetically.
Mm. Unbelievably well.
Because it was several... He loved his wife so much that he sealed her tomb with three layers of lead. Three layers of lead with tar.
Lots
you know.
Of car-
so what happened was that within the tomb that became... because there were still insects and bacteria in there, it became... They slowly ate all the oxygen, so it became an anaerobic environment. Mm. So what we have in these tombs are these perfectly preserved books, food... All kinds of artifacts from
bamboo
the Han.
Strips.
It's in the most amazing, and the corpse of the wife,
the lady, right.
that's still
the lady died.
Is,
lady died.
That was so
not that lady died.
So well preserved that when they embalmed, they could actually put embalming fluid, and it would cause the veins to actually come up. So the body was as well preserved as anything.
The tomb was excavated in the 1970s. Is that
yeah, very yeah. late. Yeah,
very late.
So anyway. That's how we have these books.
So let's hear about. I mean, I think there are probably a lot of people who have heard about what the Tao Te Ching is. People have so many different interpretations of what it really is. I'm just curious where you come down on the having done this now.
Well, when I was doing that translation, that's one of the reasons I decided to do the translation is because we had the Ma Wang Dui manuscripts. I mean, I always had said when I was teaching Chinese religion, I said, the last text on earth I want to translate is the Tao Te Ching because we have too many translations.
Yeah, more than the Bible, right?
There's a new translation of the Tao Te Ching on average about once a month and often by people who know Chinese,
no Chinese at all. Right?
Yeah.
One of the most famous translations is by, the Ezra Pound translation.
That's right.
Well, and Stephen Mitchell doesn't know Chinese and he translated the Tao Te Ching.
Yeah. Wait, did Ezra Pound translate the Tao Te Ching? Am I complete?
I don't know if he did that.
Book of Odes, right? Maybe I'm wrong.
He did the cantos. Shi Jing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Ezra Pound and...
I'm sorry, I don't mean to impugn.
So I said, well, I'll take it on because, there are a lot of obscurities in the Tao Te Ching. And I thought, and it turned out that I could solve problems by looking at these ancient manuscripts. Because before we had the Ma Wang Dui, the earliest manuscripts we had were like from the 3rd or 4th century AD. So there's a big gap between the time...
600 years.
Yeah, of the actual. And so, but actually, now after the Ma Wang Dui manuscripts were discovered later on, after my translation, another early version of the Tao Te Ching was found, and that's the Guodian manuscripts.
Right.
I don't know if you've heard of them. But that's wonderful because there you can see the Tao Te Ching in process of formation. I think they're 3rd century, maybe, I'm not sure the exact date,
so
maybe 320,
states,
something
yeah.
like that. But you can see, Laozi was not the author because he's supposed to have lived in the 6th century, right, B.C.? Mm-hmm. But here we see in the Guodian that it's definitely in process of formation. It's at an earlier stage than the Ma Wang Dui. But still, even with the Ma Wang Dui manuscripts, I was able to solve problems that I couldn't solve just with those late 6th dynasties manuscripts.
That's interesting. I mean, that's what I really wanted to hear you say. I mean, question of authorship, right? There are a lot of people who posit that Zhuangzi was actually author of the Tao Te Ching.
I don't know about that, and I don't think Zhuangzi was the author of the whole Zhuangzi.
No, there's the inner text and the outer text.
The outer chapters and the miscellaneous.
Right.
But there's a core of his thought. And, actually in the Zhuangzi there are some chapters that are antithetical to his thought. There are three chapters that begin with the term Tian, heaven.
Right.
And they're sort of...
That's right.
They're sort of pseudo-Confucian. Mm-hmm. They're very Confucian, but with a twist, like anti-Confucian. So there have been some really good studies by Christopher Rand and Hal Roth on the different strands of the Zhuangzi. And what I think about the Laozi is that it was a compilation of, like, sagely wisdom that was circulating. Mm. And one of the things that I did... Well, I did this also with the Sun Tzu. I showed that Sun Tzu was a collection of military wisdom, not by somebody named Sun Tzu. But actually, there was another set of art of war materials, and it's by a guy named Sun Bin, which means Sun Bin like kneecapped Sun. He had his kneecap knocked off. Yeah, Sun Bin, and he was a real guy. He was a real person. The Sun Tzu who wrote the Sun Wu, who
he was, would have been a great military strategist until he took that crossbow bolt to the knee.
I mean, he didn't exist. He was like a back formation from Sun Bin.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so, I mean, you can. I showed by a very careful grammatical analysis and syntactical analysis that that these sayings in the Sun Tzu Bingfa are actually just sort of like strung together. That you can see how they were just sort of grabbed and put together into a text. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing is true. I also did some of that analysis for Lao Tzu.
And you think Lao Tzu is the same way? That
it's just sagely wisdom of a circulating and put together. Because there's a lot of repetitions.
Of a school that was self-consciously Taoist at the time, was it?
Well, let's say the school that was self-consciously Taoist emerged during the process of the formation of those texts.
See. Very interesting.
But and another thing I say about Taoism is that Taoism as a religion, this is kind of heretical, but Taoism as a religion arose in response to the advent of Buddhism in China.
Yeah, I mean, I thought isn't that sort of accepted though?
It is pretty much.
You
know,
you have the
but people like Steve
the White Horse Monastery already present. You don't have religious Taoism until about 142 AD.
Absolutely.
Right?
Well, you know this because you studied it with Don Harper.
Okay. That was ages ago.
And you have a scholarly background, but most people really just buy the story of Lao Tzu being a 6th century personage who wrote that text. Cannot be. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so I mean, let me just apologize quickly to our
historical Jesus.
Wow. To our readers, our listeners who I've promised current affairs to, but we've just now strolled way back into the 4th century BCE. And actually,
it's China. That still counts as current affairs.
That's right.
too early to tell. You guys, let's make some recommendations here.
I'll start. I want to recommend a blog that Victor is actually a major contributor to, the Language Log.
Oh, yeah.
Which
yeah.
is one of the most entertaining and informative reads on the internet, all about language written by philologists, linguists, and language-obsessed people, but fascinating, well-written, and a lot of fun. It's geeky, but it's fun. It's very fun.
Geeky. Super geeky.
Yeah. Yeah, and the comments are sometimes the most fun.
Oh, yeah.
Because sometimes Victor,
very learned people join
Victor throws out a brick to attract jade, as we say in Chinese, and he gets a lot of crap, too, sometimes, yeah. too.
I
he gets
a lot of jade. One recent post that I saw on there had some your barber or your haircutter, the bizarre Chinese tattoo on the back.
Oh, yeah, you got that one.
Yeah, I saw that one. That was just very funny. I mean, one of the characters is actually upside down in mirror image. And,
right. Upside down and backwards.
And, yeah. So funny.
That's good. You see it in a mirror. You can only see it in the mirror anyway. Right. You might as well do it backwards. Yeah.
Well, you can't see the back of your neck in a mirror. Well, you can't.
Sure, you can.
If you're a barber,
hold up
you can.
Another mirror,
you can't see the back of your neck because you got too much damn hair.
I haven't seen the back of my neck for forever. That's a great recommendation. Yeah, Language Log. You know, I should have. We'll make sure to put a link to that on the.
Oh, that's great. It's an honor to write for Language Log.
Yeah, David, what do you have for us?
Back to Beijing. Another book about Beijing, if we needed that. But this is a nice book. It's by Judith Farquhar, University of Chicago, anthropologist. Zhang Qicheng.
Uh-huh.
And it's called 10,000 Things, Nurturing Life in Contemporary Beijing. And it's kind of just a love letter to Beijing, but it traces all the great things that Beijing people have as part of their tradition. The park calligraphy, the martial arts,
the kites, birds, but it
comes at it from a sense of the fact that these things are actually contribute to health and longevity and everything of the Beijing people. But it's from an anthropologist point of view.
That sounds lovely.
And instead of just being a catalog of these things and saying here's what Beijingers do, she sort of digs into it and says why it's so cool and why it's really a great lifestyle that they have, this traditional lifestyle. I haven't finished yet, but it's really nice for someone who loves Beijing. It's sort of just kind of gives you a more upbeat
Jeremy, that's
feeling.
Right up our aisle.
Upbeat.
Yeah.
We need
upbeat. Those of us are always
right up our hutong.
Gripe about Beijing. You know,
gripe about Beijing? Yeah. This is paradise, David. What are you talking about?
Victor, what do you have for us?
Well, I'll recommend a book by another old friend of mine. He's deceased, John DeFrancis.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I wrote an obituary of him on Language Log, and it's called Visible Speech. He died at age 97, so he was on his way to be catching over 100, but he choked on a piece of Peking duck on Christmas Eve.
Yeah. Very ironic.
That was so sad. Yeah, so sad. I mean, he was very happy that night.
And, yeah.
But visible speech essentially tells us that all writing systems for real language have to have a phonetic component. In other words, it really destroys the notion of ideography or pictography, that every functioning writing system has to have a very heavy phonetic component. And he proves that for Sumerian, Egyptian.
When did he write this?
Late 80s, I think.
Okay, yeah,
I
mean, the subtitle is The Oneness of Scripts or something like that.
It has
like
a very cool illustration on the front, which is 4 score and 7 years ago, or 4 fathers brought forth, in all these different scripts. And then with the sound spectroscope also showing the actual
another
sounds.
One, yeah.
Another way to record the sounds.
Right.
So I think it's a brilliant book, and it's a book that, with Chinese at the center, but still somehow on a par with all these other writers.
Chinese at the center because it's all often held up as a purely
it's the exception.
Right?
It's the exception.
I think we've talked about this before. I mean, how that is a pretty persistent myth, but we all know that there's a very strong phonetic component in Chinese characters.
85% of all Chinese characters are pictophonetic.
That's the number I got.
But you could be a very smart student and go several years before noticing that.
Yeah, right.
Unfortunately.
Suffering from Beihanzi.
Right, exactly.
So, yeah, great recommendation. John DeFrancis, the title again is
Visible Speech.
Okay, I've got something way more, well, it's more prosaic, but just to bring everybody back to the present day.
Young Ray's Weibo account?
Actually,
you should read it.
That's CCTV Young Ray, by the way.
Which is digraphia, by the way. Because he writes in English and Chinese all the time. So it's digraphia.
He's digraphic, right.
Yeah, he's digraphic.
Although that's not really
That's
bilingual.
That's diglossia.
Yeah, he's right about that. Yeah, that's true.
So anyway, the New York Times has a new piece by Ed Wong, frequent guest on the show, and Jonathan Ansfield. It's called Leaders Fall in China Puts Allies in Peril, and it gives sort of this great look at Bo Xilai's inner court about three men who were trying to sort of come in and negotiate between him and Wang Lijun, and who ended up sort of seeing the writing on the wall and hightailing it to Australia, then thinking things were clear, it was okay to get back in the water, but then they got nabbed. And It's a fascinating story.
How do they get this stuff so fast?
You know, I'm
it's amazing.
I'm just in awe of the reporting chops of some of these guys. It's been really great. Anyway, for next week's show, and that will be on June 1st, I believe, we've got PRI's Mary Kay Magistad hosting an all-women Seneca. While Jeremy enjoys, you're going to be in the Australian
autumn
there, right?
Yeah.
And I will be drinking beer with the interns in the control room, ceding control here to Mary Kay and crew. We want to thank you all for coming. Thank you very much, Dr. Victor Mayer.
Yeah.
David Moser, and of course, Jeremy. And we will see you guys all next week on the Seneca Podcast. Take care.